So as I just said a few minutes ago, I've been on retreat with a group of people since Thursday, so I absolutely have no idea what's going on in the so-called outside world. I would imagine it's all still there. And I would imagine, you know, the various characters are still doing what they've always been doing. I mean, no radical changes. No, okay, people are shaking their head. Okay, just checking. And again, as I alluded to earlier, you know, the one significant thing for those of us here was the passing of Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich means teacher. Thich Nhat Hanh, Thich Nhat Hanh, a week ago Friday in Vietnam, where he had returned. A week ago Sunday, we had a memorial service here. That's why we have a special altar set up for him. And one of the things I said, because I'm going to be talking again about this Zen master Bunke this morning, was I really felt that the matter at hand for this retreat and Bunke's teaching very much fit in with Thich Nhat Hanh. Because Thich Nhat Hanh was a, you know, one of his, I mean, even though the depth of his knowledge of Buddhism and his experience as a meditation master was vast, one of the things he had a genius for in this life was being very creative in simplifying aspects of Buddhist meditation, Buddhist teaching, so they can be easily understood and accessed to a wide variety of people, right? And I think that is why if you look at the news and everything, you'll see, you know, his passing is covered quite extensively all throughout the world, and, you know, many, many people of all types have been affected by him. And his, you know, when you came down to it, he gave myriad different kinds of teachings. It was all about, you know, this line is taken from, I have arrived, I am home. He wanted to get us to come home, to come home to ourselves, to come home to the moment, come home to the freshness of this present moment, come home to our true home, and to leave aside all the things that rile us up and cause us affliction in all the areas of our life, whether it's a society, whether it's in relationships, whether just it's within the own person. So he was a great presenter of Dharma in a very creative way, but his message was always very simple, right? Learn to live happily, peacefully, in the present moment. So I felt that this retreat, which we had set up before we knew he had, Thich Nhat Hanh had died, was in that line, because Bunke also, and imagine most people have never heard of Bunke. He's really sort of an unknown, but in his time, he was very well known. So let me just say a few things about him for those who weren't on the retreat. And how many people are online, Angie? 127, and we have about 30, 40 in the hall. So most of the people who are listening were not on retreat. Okay. So let me just say a few things. I hope the people on retreat don't mind. So it's 1600s Japan. There's a young man named Bunke. He wasn't called Bunke then, you know, they changed their names along. But he was a young man, he was very bright, but very unruly. he was the leader of in the village of the mischief makers, right? He had a mind of his own. And so when he was sent to school, it was a Confucianist school, which I guess was dominated that time. And the teacher was teaching something about bright virtue, which is a Confucian term. Always live in bright virtue or something like that. And so, you know, Bunke was one of these guys who, you know, one of these kids who raises hands, teacher, what does bright virtue mean? You know, and so the teacher would give him another explanation all intellectual. But he said, well, what does that really mean? You know, what really is that? And eventually he, his teacher told him to shut up. And it was sort of like that. But Bankei, and he was also supposedly from a very early age, very scared of death. His mother said afterwards that if they ever wanted to shut him up, all they had to do was start talking about death, and he immediately started crying, right? So he was obviously, and even though he was a tough little kid on one way, he was obviously very sensitive. And then his father actually died when he was 10, which was significant. And the house was kind of, you know, then it passed to the elder brother, and Bankei was just unruly. You know, he if he didn't like a class being taught at school, he would cut it, as we would say these days, and you know, and he talked back to teachers. And so eventually his brother threw him out of the house, I think when he was 13. He was on his own. But he had this question, you know, what is bright virtue, or what is the meaning of things? You know what I mean? It was just very interesting, this deep thing within him. And he then spent years, I mean, I'm just fast forward, he just spent years going to Confucian and Shintoist and Pure Land and Zen, all kinds of teachers, you know, and he was frustrated. And then he'd go and he'd live in huts, he'd live outdoors. I mean, he was you know, very ascetic, right? He wouldn't eat, he'd fast for weeks. I mean, he would do anything. He had this deep need to know. He eventually found a Zen teacher who told him, you know, stop looking, you know, it's your looking that's getting in the way. You're just always searching outside yourself, you know, do meditation, it's all within, right? And so he built himself a hut and he just, you know, sat day and night. So anyhow, where'd this all get him? Got him a very weakened constitution and significant pneumonia. And basically, when the doctor was called to visit him, and he was living in this little hut, right? This little, said basically, you know, you're gonna die. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, no medicine's gonna help you. And so he was kind of at the end of his rope. You know, I mean, all his striving had basically not gotten him what he wanted, and it basically, you know, destroyed his physical life. And it was at that moment, and it's very interesting, his enlightenment experience. So he's there, right, near death, you know, coughing up blood, but he's still meditating. And at some point, he coughs up a bunch of sputum, a bunch of kind of bloody sputum in his mouth, and he spits it against the wall. And at that moment, seeing the bloody sputum going down the wall, as it said in Zen, the bucket totally fell out. The bottom of the bucket fell out. What does that mean? In that moment, all his concepts, all his thoughts, all his constructs about who he was and who he wasn't or anything, like all fell away. And all of a sudden, dumbstruck. It was like, oh my God, it's so simple. He didn't say, oh my God, it was me. It's so simple. And and what he reports is what he said to himself, everything is resolved in the unborn mind, the unborn Buddha mind. Okay. And then, you know, he continued the practice for years, just cultivating that deep understanding that had come to him. And one of the things, and eventually he started teaching, right? And he became a great teacher. I mean, they said eventually he would hold these three-month sessions, 5,000-10,000 people would come to him. You know, and, you know, priests and monks and nuns from all the Buddhist sects would come to him, as well many lay people and many uneducated people. I mean, he you know, farmers and tradesmen. I mean, why? Because he made it so simple. And that's what I want to talk to you about. He made it so simple. And his teaching was the product of his own experience, because he had endlessly worked and striven, and he realized that had always gotten in the way, that in truth, and again, so his enlightenment is very much like the Buddha's enlightenment, you know, that this, he called it the unborn mind, right? You know, those familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, no birth, no death, no coming, no going. It's the same mind, right? Because anything that is never born can never die. And so his great enlightenment was that not only him, but all beings, which means all of us, our mind, our original mind right now, right? That mind that is listening to my words right now without any effort at all, and understanding what I'm saying without any effort at all, this very natural mind is our true mind. And within it, everything is resolved. There are no problems, there are no issues. It's pure, it's uncontaminated, it embraces everything. It's a source of all goodness. And all we need to do is what? Live in it. Live in it. So his practice was very simple. Abide in the unborn mind. Abide in your natural mind. Right? If you want to meditate, meditate. If you want to chant, chant. If you want to work your fields, work your fields, right? Whatever you do, wherever you go, simply abide in the unborn mind. And we'll talk a little about that. But that's really no different than when Thich Nhat Hanh says what? Rest in the present moment. Or he says, you know, with every step, we enter the world of the absolute. So it's all right here. Right. So, you know, an obvious question for all of us could be, well, how come I don't experience that? See, it's so simple, right? And I mean, and his basic teaching was, you know, again, he was a Buddhist priest. He had studied Buddhism, he had practiced in temples, he was very familiar with, you know, all the wonderful Buddhist teachings and practices. But what he said was, the one thing that was missing and was always so frustrating to him all those years of searching, was he could not find anybody that had realized this unborn mind, right? There were lots of people who could talk about it, lots of teachers who could talk about it, even give instruction, but they themselves hadn't done it, right? And so he felt this is the most important thing, right? Because again, in his culture, society of the time, there were lots of Buddhist temples, there were lots of Buddhist teachers, there were lots of meditation halls, there were lots of chanting halls, there were lots of places for people to learn Buddhist philosophy and teaching, but he felt there really was nowhere where people could just wake up to their original Buddha mind, okay? So that peace, right? That became his specialty, right? So it wasn't like he dispensed with all that other stuff. He just said, for realization, it's not needed. All you need to do is abide in your unborn mind. Again, I'll read about that. There were a couple of good quotes this morning that I wanted to when we had our sharing at the end from people, I want to share with you. So, the fundamental teaching, abide in the unborn mind, and I'll take your questions about that. But to do that, okay, so it's like this. He just affirmed what the Buddha taught. That Buddha taught what? From his own great enlightenment. Inherently, everyone's a Buddha, right? It's not like, you know, we're ordinary beings with our own ordinary minds and our own ordinary nature, and we have to somehow become something else, right? We have to access this thing called the enlightened mind. We have to become somebody different than ourselves. We have to become an enlightened person, you see? It's like this has to become that. The teaching of Buddha, which was reaffirmed by Bhanke, it's not like that at all. In our true nature, we are already inherently Buddhas. It's already right here, which is, you know, good news. I mean, it's really quite significant, isn't it, to say that? Because most people, they think their mind is really, you know, you put all your thoughts together, all your memories together, all your stories together, all your narratives together, all your beliefs together, all your issues and problems together. You know, you add that all up and what do you get? Me. Does that sound familiar? See, that's who we think we are. But the Buddha, Bhanke, said, not true. Intrinsically, we're Buddhas, which means intrinsically we have an enlightened mind. It's a matter of uncovering it. It's a very different process, you see. It's like I got to get things off it rather than I got to go make it or find it. I mean, do you see the significant difference there and how simple that is? I mean, not that it's the simplest thing to do, but the process is so simple and so easily to understand, right? Probably uneducated people would probably get it better than, you know, people like us who are overeducated. We think everything. So basically what his message to people who came was abide in the unborn mind and stop cultivating delusion. It's like, and what is delusion? Basically, the way he talked about it was, quite simply, when we are born, all of us here were born, when we were infants, when we were young children, our minds were pure. We had no language, right? We had no biases. We had no anger. We had no fear. We had no jealousy. We had, you know, we didn't have anything, did we? No, our minds were pure, empty. And yet we were totally alive, totally aware. When it was cold, we knew it was cold. When it was hot, we knew it was hot. When we were hungry, you know, we knew it was time to eat. You know, when it was time to defecate, we knew how to do that. You know. Right? We smiled when we were happy. We cried when we were sad. I mean, he said, that's where we all began, right? That's a touch that shows us that's our original nature for everyone, right? People you like, people you dislike. People you love, people you hate. All the same. We all have the same nature. So then the obvious question is, what happened, right? Well, basically what Bhanke says is, you know, since nobody had understood this before you were born, everybody had just been very busy not knowing who they were intrinsically, but thinking that they were their bodies, thinking they were their desires, their needs, their wants, their hopes, their fears, right? Everybody, based on some fundamental delusions, had been very busy, what? Just building on their delusions, right? Is fabricating more and more delusions about themselves and life and everybody else. And that's what everybody's mind was filled with. So basically what Bhanke says is, you know, this pure being, us, and of course those people before them, you know, grow up in a family and a society where everybody's deluded. And basically, you know, we're constantly from early on being educated and how to be a deluded human being. I mean, this is Bhanke's kind of take on thing, right? Until we, you know, just built it, and that's, you know, and that's who we think we are. That's how we live from. Right? You know? So now, what does he say? If you stop cultivating delusive delusion, that's the best way to be able to feel and experience your unborn mind. You will never do it as long as you're cut up in delusive thinking. Right? And he really said thinking. Now, when thinking does not mean thoughts, a thought is just a thought. But thinking is when we link thoughts, when we embroider thoughts, when we, you know, create stories about everything, right? You know, we are no longer just, so he says his practice was stop grasping at thoughts. Let them arise, don't push them away. Don't grasp, and they will just go away of their own. Same teaching as Thich Nhat Hanh. Okay? Just let go of all that stuff. Somebody this morning thought that somebody, and we're not sure, but thought that somebody early on had given them a quote of Bonnke's, which was, delusion is the anguish of thought feeding on thought. I thought that was brilliant. Delusion is the anguish of thought feeding on thought. And basically, a lot of what Bonnke would teach was, we have this pure nature, undefiled, totally open and spacious. And he said, because of our delusion, we turn it into something else, right? You know, you know, and he uses Buddhist terminology. He says, you know, we turn it into a hungry ghost. A hungry ghost is kind of a being who just has incredible thirst and is never satisfied, right? You know, that's sort of like the person who is never satisfied. We're always needing, always wanting, always desiring. And it doesn't matter how many needs we fulfill, how many desires we fulfill, we always have that craving. That's a hungry ghost. He said, you say you turn a hungry ghost, or you turn it into a fighting demon. You know, that's what he called anger. You know, you take this wonderful, open, spacious, true nature, and just with a few twists, all of a sudden, you know, you're a rageaholic, right? He says, you know, it's amazing. He says at some point, you know, you could be here listening to my talk, feeling very wonderful, relaxing, you know, in the Buddha mind. You know, you go out of here, you know, somebody bumps into you, and immediately you start growing horns, you know, just like a demonic beast, you know, right? So he goes on like that, or, you know, all the afflictive emotions, all the afflictive mindsets. He says, you know, that's what we're doing. We're taking this pure original nature, turning them into all these painful states. So he said, we just got to stop. And how do we stop? Not by stopping, not by struggling, which is what people think they need to do, but simply by being mindful when they arise and just let them go. He said, then they can't affect you. An angry thought, a jealous thought, a fearful thought, all kinds of thoughts could arise, right? But if you don't grab at them, if you don't link them, they can't affect you, can they? So that's why I say his path was very easy. You know? It wasn't a lot you had to do other than, you know, recognize that all thoughts are impermanent. None of them have any substance. They just endlessly come and go, and just let them go. Just like what we do in meditation. The other thing, practice he would give people would be, he'd say, you know, at the root of the whole thing is your self-centeredness, right? That's what it's all about. I mean, all your fears, all your angers, all your cravings, all the thing. It's because, you know, you identify yourself as a separate self, and you're always partial, which means you're always centered on yourself. Right? And he said, this is the root of the whole thing. I mean, basically, again, he kind of brooked no nonsense. He said, just give it up. Give up your self-centeredness. Right? It's the cause of your suffering. You know, the self is always needing, always wanting. He gave an example that I read to people yesterday at some point. He said, you know, your neighbors are fighting, right? You can hear them through the window. It doesn't make you angry, right? And you hear them and you kind of, you know, in your intelligence, you can hear, you know, the validity of both sides, right? You know, right? You know, you can kind of get it. Yeah. You can see this one's point of view and that one's point of view. And you don't get angry, right? You're very objective, very intelligent, right? But he said, if you're one of those people, right? If you're one of those people and it's happening to you, you've decided I'm on this side. And I'm right and they're wrong and I'm good and they're bad, right? And if I'm angry, I'm only angry because they made me angry, right? So he uses simple examples to show how it's that identification with self, which is the cause of so many of our problems. And then the third thing was bad habits. You know, he said, you know, we all have to do our self-examination. Just watch your mind, watch your behavior, and you'll probably see that you have bad habits. You know, bad habits that, aren't conducive to your own well-being or the well-being of your relationships, you know. And you have to just, you know, change those bad habits, develop good habits. So, you know, simple teaching. And the other wonderful thing he said, which was his kind of enlightenment epiphany, which is all things are resolved in the unborn. In the unborn, there are no problems. In the unborn, there are no issues, right? So all the things that we feel like we got to resolve, we got to figure out, we got to get the answer to, if we just rest in our unborn mind, it's all resolved. Everything's fine. Everything's perfect. Now, the thinking, self-oriented mind goes, no, it can't be that simple, right? Or wrong. Right? Could he be right and we're wrong? That it is that simple? Because his sense, he says, the unborn is like a mirror. Our natural mind is like a mirror. It just reflects whatever arises. Right? And our unborn mind is more than just a mirror than reflect. It has this natural intelligence and wisdom, this knowing. And it can respond, you know, just respond to situations as they arise. Right? We don't have to really think about it and fixate on it. And, you know, we can just, you know, live life from our unborn mind, free and easy. And whatever arises, we just deal with it. And that our natural mind has its own intelligence, which is hard for us to trust, which is actually more intelligent than the usual thing we rely on, which is our deluded, self-biased mind, right? You see, that's what we allow to kind of figure things out for us. Anybody notice that doesn't really work? Bankei said, you know what that's like? He says, it's like there's a blood stain on the floor and you go get yourself a bucket of blood and you dip your cloth in the bucket of blood and you very diligently clean up the stain. The problem with that, of course, it will only create another stain. And he said, that's what we're doing. You know, we're endlessly... It is our thinking, deluded mind that is creating the problems in our life. Then we let it, you know, resolve things for us, fix things for us. And then we're surprised that the next day, you know, we have more problems. that this mind is creating. And we just gotta let it, you know, you see, we're always, well, I think you get it, right? So, yeah, so that's a sense of Zen Master Bankei. So let me give you a little flavor. And again, you know, he didn't write anything. That's one of the reasons he didn't write anything. And he was not big on structure or forms at all. So within not too many generations after his passing, even though he had many, many, many disciples, that he had monasteries, eventually everything faded away. And it was only in this own century that a Japanese Zen scholar kind of rediscovered him. You know, he wouldn't even let his disciples write anything down that he wrote, but secretly a couple of them wrote down some of his sermons and some of his letters and some of his interactions with people. But the corpus of his work is very small. I mean, this is there are two books, one's called Bankei that have been translated in English, one's called Bankei Zen, and there's another one, they're both very good. Yeah, it was all very alive and for him. So again, there's not a lot, but what I was saying was, you get a sense that he kept saying the same thing over and over again. It's like he just had a simple teaching, because in the book, there are some of the dialogues are sort of, you know, sort of Zen priests or other people coming to him and saying, you know, you keep saying the same thing over and over again, you know, this, you know, why don't you liven things up a bit, you know, because, you know, quote Buddhist teachings more often, and, you know, talk about the, you know, the masters of old, you know. You know, Bankei said, no, I teach only one thing, the unborn mind and how to realize it. And it sounds as if there's another one where his sermon starts off saying, could those of you in the front rows please get up and let the people behind you come to the front, because I'm just going to start over again. And they came late, so that's why they're in the back. So now I'm going to start over. So, you know, let them be in the front and you can be in the back, you know. And there was another place where he said, where he just acknowledged, yeah, I say the same thing over and over again, right? And he said, some of you, it's all new. And, you know, you need to ponder it. You need to reflect on it. You need to practice. Some of you have been aware of this for a number of years and practiced with me. So this is just, re-empowers you. And you know, we're all together. And it kind of, strengthens your understanding and practice. But basically, my sense was, he had his specialty. Right, his specialty was, no matter who you were, no matter who you thought you were, he was here to reveal to you your unborn mind and tell you how to abide in it and tell you how to get rid of what gets in the way. And that's all he was concerned with. So he was a unique being. But let me give you, I mean, those you've been on retreat have had a flavor of him. Here's a little poem. Chasing after words, pursuing phrases, when will you ever be done? You run yourself ragged, amassing knowledge, becoming more and more informed. Self-nature, which means our own true nature, is empty and illuminating. So let things take care of themselves. That was another one of his great, you know, just let things be. There's nothing else I have to pass on. Here's another, this is called an impromptu poem. Not angry when abused, not happy when praised, a great blockhead of the universe. Going along as circumstances carry me, north, south, east, west, without hiding my ugliness and clumsiness between heaven and earth. Can you see it? You know, he's totally open, you know? if they castigate me, if they say all kinds of terrible things about me, right, I don't get angry. Right? If they say wonderful things about me and praise me, I don't get happy. I'm just a great blockhead. Going along where, as circumstances carry me north, south, east, west. How many of us can say that? Yeah, I just flow along with things in life. I just accord with things. Is that true? Or do we always, we're always trying to manipulate and control and strategize, right? That's the self, you see? And where does it get us? We have to ask ourselves, where does it get us? So he says, I'm just going along as circumstances carry me, north, south, east, west, without hiding my ugliness and clumsiness between heaven and earth. This was, you know, one of his, he says over and over again, just be yourself. The people, just be yourself. You are who you are. Just be yourself. Just be your natural, spontaneous self. You know, not your fabricated self, not the self that your deluded, poor deluded parents and your poor deluded teachers and your poor deluded society kind of, you know, molded and that you became. But, you know, find your natural self, right? That self, you know, that who you were when you first came in, sort of if you haven't been conditioned and let freely raised to be you. And again, he says, I don't hide my ugliness. In ugliness is like, I don't hide my so-called imperfections. I don't hide my clumsiness. I'm me. I mean, I'm not sure what he looked like. He says, it's just me. It's like, you know, no self-consciousness. He didn't hide. He didn't pretend. He didn't try to, you know, fit in like everybody else. On the other hand, he didn't try to stand out, right? He was just himself. I mean, what wonderful advice. So here's another one. He says, what does it matter, the new year, the old year? So it's probably, you know, maybe New Year ceremonies, right? And he's, I don't know where he is. You know, it's the new year, everybody's doing their ceremonies in the temple for the new year. What does it matter, the new year, the old year? You know, the passing of time, which of course everybody in the world is very concerned about. I stretch out my legs and all alone have a quiet sleep. That's how he's celebrating the new year. Comfortable, stretched out, taking a nap. Then he says, don't tell me the monks aren't getting their instruction. Right? Here and there, the nightingale is singing the highest Zen. Right? Most people think, you know, instruction is always words. Right? He says, I'm getting my instruction right now. Listen to the nightingale, just this. This is the highest Zen. No thought, no concept, just this. Yeah, so that's some poetry. Here's just a little bit, and then I'll take questions. And so this is sort of the way he would talk to his, and again, in the early days, you know, but there were hundreds, but they say by the end, 5,000-10,000 people would come, and he would hold these three-month sessions. Like, the temple would be filled, they'd have to erect special tent, everybody in the village would sort of become a B&B, you know, I mean, they said it was quite a thing, and it went on for months. I mean, people just came from all over Japan, to receive his teaching. So again, these are this collection of sermons, but only really from one short period of time. Again, his disciples surreptitiously, secretly, got together after he had talked and kind of recreated what he had said, because he forbid them to do it. The master instructed the assembly, "As you've been hearing me say, everyone has the innate Buddha mind. So all you need to do is abide in the unborn just as it is. However, following the ways of the world, you get into bad habits in life and switch the Buddha mind for the wretched realm of the hungry ghost with its clinging and craving. But if you grasp it thoroughly, meaning what he's teaching, you'll always abide in the unborn Buddha mind. If you want to abide in the unborn Buddha mind, try to stop your thoughts of anger and rage, your thoughts of clinging and craving. You try to stop them from arising. Then when you try to stop them, you're dividing your mind in two, right? If as if you were pursuing something that's running away. You're always chasing, so, you know. As long as you are deliberately trying to stop your rising thoughts, the thought of trying to stop them wars against the continually arising thoughts, and there's never an end to it." I'm sure everybody here knows what he's talking about. And then he gives that example, I won't give it again, of the blood. And again, similarly, the original angry thoughts that you were able to stop may have come to an end, but the subsequent thoughts concerned with your stopping them won't ever cease. So you'll always be doing it. Well, he says, you may wonder then, what can I do to stop them? And he said, even if suddenly, despite yourself and wholly unawares, and that's actually how's it true. Most people don't think, all right, something's happened, now I'm going to get angry. Something's happened, now I'm going to get irritated. Something's happened, now I think I'm going to start worrying about it, right? If you think about it, do you consciously, does that how it works? No. It just comes up. All of a sudden a thought, a memory, you know, it just comes up. The feeling comes up. It's not our doing. You see? We say, oh, that, you know, I'm getting angry, or that made me angry, but that's not true. You know, that's why I'm scared. That's why I'm anxious. That's why, but that's not true. It just arises, right? From our delusions. So despite and wholly unawares, rage, anger, and again, you can put in whatever your favorite delusion is. Okay, so put in all your favorite delusions. They just arrive. He says, just let them come. Just don't develop them any further. Don't attach to them. Which is the same teaching Thich Nhat Hanh says, right? Just be aware. When things arise in the mind, even afflictive things, just be aware. Hold them in mindfulness. Don't feed them. Without concerning yourself whether to stop your rising thoughts or not stop them, just don't bother with them. And then there's nothing else they can do but stop. Now, why is that? Because it is the nature of thoughts and feelings to be impermanent. That is their nature, like everything else. They just arise and disappear, right? In our meditation, you sit, you're focusing on your awareness of your body, your breath, and what happens? Thoughts arise. Is that true? Without you even wanting them, don't they just arise? Right? And after they disappear, and they'll always disappear, what happens? Another one arises. And that goes on from morning till night. Right? That is the nature of thoughts. But the grasping at them, the embroidering them, the linking one to another, the making stories out of them, that's our doing. So if it's our doing, we can undo it. Now, again, this is very simple, right? But it takes some mind strength, doesn't it, to do it? It takes somebody who's really looked into the nature of thoughts and really seeing, by looking into their own mind, yeah, these thoughts, they just come and go, endlessly come and go. And it has nothing to do with me. They just arise by themselves. Right? Why do I grasp onto them? Why do I identify with them, with me, since I'm not even the one who produced them? I mean, it's kind of crazy, isn't it? I mean, if a car went roaring up Nebraska blasting their music, would you get angry yourself? No. Just somebody, driving by, blasting their music, right? You wouldn't get angry. And then it's gone. But when it's, why, when we think of something arises in our mind, it's me. Since, I didn't produce it, did I? We think we did. But if you look in your mind, you see you didn't produce it. Just watch your mind. Thoughts come from nowhere and they go nowhere. That is their nature. Without concerning yourself whether to stop your rising thoughts or not stop them, just don't bother with them, and then there's nothing else they can do but stop. You can't have an argument with a fence if you're standing there all alone. When there's no one to fight with, things can't help but simply come to an end of them with themselves. Stop struggling. Stop fighting with yourself. Just let things be. Even when all sorts of thoughts do crop up, it's only for the time being. While they arise, they will eventually all disappear. So if you're not following your delusions around all day, what are you doing? As Thich Nhat Hanh would say, you stay home. You just rest in your mind, which means your natural awareness. You're just present to things, right? When you walk, you just walk. Right? When you eat, you just eat. When you work, you just work. When you brush your teeth, you just brush your teeth. When you're with somebody, you're just with somebody. One of the things I've said to the people on retreat, it's almost like we have two tracks, you see? There's the track of reality. Everybody know that track? See, that's what you're doing all day. Think about your day. What do you think in real terms? Everybody close your eyes. What's your day like? And while you're doing that, I'm going to take this sweater off. I think the heat has begun to come up in the hall. For those of you who aren't here in Florida, we are in our winter. I think we might have even had a freeze last night. Sorry, I didn't have my microphone on. So what do we do all day? I mean, what do we actually do? Okay, just close your eyes. We wake up, right? And then we wake up, we go do something. For many people, the first thing we do is what? Go to the bathroom, go make coffee or tea, right? Isn't that what we do? We just do things. Then we may go to work, or we may do this, or we may do that, right? We read the news. I mean, we're just doing things, right? We do things, go for a walk, drive somewhere, right? Lunch comes, we eat lunch, and we just continue doing things. We make it to dinner, you know, make dinner, eat dinner, clean up from dinner. Then after dinner, we do something, right? Isn't that all we're doing every day? If we were kind of just, you know, watching ourselves, right? Can you see yourself? You're just doing things all day. Different things, right? Different things happen, different circumstances. You respond as, you know, I mean, things happen during all those things. Right? This thing happens, that happens. This one does this, one does, you respond, right? You're just doing things, responding. See, that's our natural, spontaneous Buddha mind, just kind of living life, very aware, very present. Is that what it's like for you? No. Because what else is going on? You see, there's this alternative track, right? You see, it's like we have these, it's like two tracks, you know? It's like, like here's the, what? Here's the calm kind of ambient music right over here, right? It's all very calm and peaceful, just kind of moving along, you know. Then over here is the what? The metal, what's that stuff? Metal rock or what? Heavy metal. Is it? Right? You see, oh, you know, it's like, you see, it's like two tracks, you see? Over here, it's all calm and peaceful, just kind of doing what you're doing. And over here, it's all this heavy metal stuff going on. And it's silent for a while, you come back to this track and crash over here. Which is real? Which is real? Ask yourself, which is my real life? Please, just close your eyes and ask yourself that. Where is my real life? Which is it? Is it in the unfolding of my life? But if, as our life's unfolding, we're not present to it, and we're just present to the soundtrack, the drama track, we're not gonna experience our real life. We're gonna be experiencing this. That's what Bankei calls the mind of delusion, the mind of drama. The mind of up and down, the mind of affliction, right? All our issues. And we're going to miss here, because here, not only is just life like boring life, but rich life, you know, people, relationships, communication, blue skies, you know? Pets, I mean, all kinds of good things. Music, reading, meditating, you know. All kinds of good things are going on in this daily life that if we're just open to it, we can touch it. But if we can't touch it because we think our delusions are. And again, our delusions are self-created. They don't really exist. Now, somebody may take issue with me because they certainly seem real, don't they? Our problems, our life problems and delusions, right? Our afflictions. But if they're real, they have to exist in some real way, don't they? To say something's real. See, I mean, if I talk about the book and you say, well, show me the book, I can what? I can hold you up and say, here's one of the books on Bankei. Bankei Zen, Translations from the Record of Bankei by Peter Haskell. Right? And you'll know I'm not just making it up. See, if somebody says, I don't know, sounds a lot like Fred's kind of making Bankei up just to justify himself, right? He's just, all my teachings come from Bankei, see? I can say, no, you read it yourself. You see, Bunke Zen. Now, if I said to you, I'm enjoying a cup of tea up here. You say, well, is that really tea or is that high-test coffee? You know, what are you going to do? I could give you a taste and say, here, try it. You'll see. It's true. I'm drinking tea. But if I said to you, can you look inside your mind and see your issues? Please, right now, look inside your mind and find your issues. Just pick any of your major issues. You have an issue with somebody. You may have a self-esteem issue. You may have all kinds of issues. You may have an anger issue, a fear issue, a stress issue. Look at all that. Now look directly in your mind right now. Can you see something called an issue? Just close your eyes and look. What do you see? Do you see anything called an issue? Do you see anything called a problem? When you look directly? I mean, that's what we think they are. I mean, that's what we're thinking about them. That's where we're generating the problem. Can anybody find one of their issues? Like, just see it. It's right there, and they could take it out and show it to me. Anybody online, anybody in the hall, anybody found something called their issue? No, I mean, I'm serious. I'd love to see one. Anybody online, Angie? No, nobody's offering one. How many people are online? 120, maybe 30, 40 in the hall. Kind of fairly diverse group, so, you know, we can say this is a fairly decent small sample of human beings. Why can't we, when we look directly for them, can we not find our issues and problems? Anybody have an idea why that is? Anybody online, anybody in the hall? They're not real? Really? Young Max over here, they're not real. Anybody else?
Trauma stored in the body, can't they be detected chemically or by CAT scans or things like that?
You know, we can store our afflictions in our body. We can store them in our mind. Yeah. I mean, you know, a CAT scan can pick up your anger. They can pick changes in your brain chemistry. You know, we know fear, anger, trauma, all these kinds of things. People internalize them. Yeah. But that's not what I'm talking about. You know, there's something deeper going on here. At that moment of experience, see, even for trauma, at that moment of experience, there was a holding on. There was a holding on. There was an internalizing. And that there was a process afterwards in which the person continues within their own body, mind, to remember, to hold on, to internalize, to have all kinds of secondary. And yeah, you know, body, mind are one. Of course they affect each other. I mean, that's not surprising. But whatever the experience was, that happened in the past, it's over, isn't it? It's no longer happening. which is the process of healing. To realize the past is over. I don't have to keep repeating the past. No matter how traumatic it was. I mean, if that wasn't true, there'd be no path of healing and transformation, would there be? You know, this is the path of healing and transformation. This is not a path of maintaining our suffering. And this is not a path of holding on to beliefs that only maintain and sustain our suffering. We can be free. We can be healed. We can become whole. Why is that? Because in our unborn mind, we are already whole. We already are. But again, not knowing that, we dwell in our afflictive mind and we identify with our afflictive mind. And we have no experience of our unborn mind, which is right here, right? Is that true? Yeah, of course it's true. Anyhow, this is a little taste of Bankei. It's been a wonderful retreat. We had our closing circle early this morning. Everybody shared their experience. Happy to say that pretty much everybody got some great benefit from it. Even though it was only 3 days, you know, this is a lifetime of work. Very beneficial. Hope hearing about it for everybody else has been beneficial. And we will continue together. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, especially to all the retreatants. Please take it with you.